Possession number 13522.
Mr. O'Brien, reel five. Reel four.
The equipment that which we had, as I said, was all American, but one thing we did keep was our green berets. We wore the green beret on our commando raids, and we wore them at Chosin. All the American forces wore their steel helmets, and they could not understand why we did not wear a helmet. We wore the beret simply because it was our beret, and we didn't want to be encumbered with a steel helmet. But we were so easily identified by the other Americans that wherever we went, we would be called out, "Hey, you Brits, you're great guys," or whatever. And on this particular occasion, having taken Jimmy Stanley into the first aid tent where he was being tended to, we came across this vehicle where these Americans were cooking meals, and this Yank shouted out, Hey, Brit, you want something to eat?" And I picked up a piece of cardboard of a ration pack, like the ration packs which all the troops use, and that was my plate. And I said, "What can I have?" And he said, "We've got flapjacks." And I'd never even seen it or heard of a flapjack at that time. And I said, "Well," he said, "you call them pancakes. They're like a round flapjack." And I can remember this as though it was yesterday. He put 14 flapjacks on that piece of cardboard. And then he poured some honey, like treacle stuff, over it. And he did the same for my mate. And we stood there, and then he put a steaming mug of coffee there and said, "Some hot coffee." And then flapjacks went down so beautiful. And that really was the way in which we saw the Americans. In the middle of everything, they were organized to do something like that. And they did it so matter-of-factly. A mortar could have just landed on that vehicle and blown them asunder, but they stood there as though they're in the middle of, Central Park, and talking so casually, which to me, a lot of people run the Americans down, but these American Marines, their morale and their attitude was fantastic. And as a young Royal Marine, I adapted myself to that, and this is my way of seeing the American forces. And a lot of people might say the Americans are rubbish, but the American Marines at Chosin were absolutely marvelous. They were fantastic people. They were fantastic fighters, because they were in exactly the same situation as we were, and doing exactly the same thing. And there was youngsters there of the same age as me, and we just smile and talk together and then move on. It's the most unusual thing that you can ever imagine. And this is where a bond of friendship grew. And that bond of friendship has gone on and on and on. And 40 years later, I've been to America, and you get treated like a welcoming hero. It is absolutely fantastic. And this bond is so unique, because you all suffered the same situation together, and it has never ever been really repeated. Now I can look back on more of the tactical side of the situation. There was approximately 120,000 Chinese troops. There was approximately 15,000 American troops, including our small group of 100 Royal Marines. The others had been wounded or taken prisoner or been killed at that time. And so we were fighting literally to survive, and we were laid on the ground shoulder to shoulder, one speaking like a New Yorker and me speaking like a Cockney. And the comments which you got was, "You funny speaking guys, you know." This is the conversation was not about war. It was everything else but, you know, in a quiet moment, you say, "Hey, where do you come from?" You know, and you say, "Oh, I come from Nebraska," you know. And then the next thing, you know, you'd be laying dead. It's just gone. You know, his head's blown off. And a bond of friendship grew out of that. Well, the tactical situation was that on the west coast of Korea, the Chinese army had swept down on the British and forced them south very, very quickly. In fact, units were completely captured. The Gloucesters put up a fantastic battle and they were overrun, and practically the whole of the Gloucester regiment was captured in mass, you know, so many hundred of them, whatever. At Chosin in Hagaru, if we'd have started to retreat, we just couldn't go quickly because there was only that one narrow winding track. So even if you'd have wanted to go, you couldn't. Plus the fact that there was General Smith, the American general, and a fantastic American colonel called Chesty Puller. He was a fantastic man to speak to. I spoke to him, you know, just to sort of going by and sort of said, "Hello, sir." And he said, "You guys, you're great." You know, and he's so forceful. And they were talking together, and this was literally what was said. "We're completely surrounded by the enemy." And he turned around and says, "Now the bastards won't get away." As if to say, whatever way we go, we're going to get them. You know, it's comical. And General Smith and Chesty Puller, with the other officers in conference, decided that it would be a tactical withdrawal rather than a runaway withdrawal, which meant that we'd take out our wounded, we wouldn't leave anything behind, we'd take out our dead, and there was enough of them. And we'd also take out as much equipment as possible, and at the same time we would fight our way back out. And this is what we did. On the 6th of December, most of the others that had been out on other locations had managed to get back into the perimeter of Hagaru. And on the 6th of December, they started a long fight to get back down to Hamnung. Bearing in mind that Koteri was also surrounded. Everywhere along that route was surrounded and being attacked. And I think there was 9 Chinese divisions on the whole of that area. And that is some numbers of men, when you think. And on the 6th of December, we started to pull out. And 4-1 Independent Commando, what was left of us, were put as rear guard to bring up parts of the rear against them coming up behind us, as you might say. But at the same time, those who had started at the front were under fire as well from the hillsides as they went back down, all down this way. And on the way back down, there's a book there and you'll see some photographs. On the way back down, we picked up some of our dead who'd been killed, and it was terrible to see. Some of them had been stripped of their clothing, not because of atrocities, but the Chinese had taken it to put warm clothing on themselves. Others, well, you could see how they'd been like that, with their feet up, where they'd been, had their clothes pulled off them as they were dying, like, and then they'd frozen in that position. And we buried them in a mass grave at Koteri. We buried quite a few at Hagaru Ri in mass graves with bulldozers. But once the order came to move out, any dead then and what dead we had were put on vehicles, and they came along with us on the vehicles, And the only people allowed on the vehicles which were moving back down to safety were the wounded and the dead. And, of course, a driver. Anybody else, if he was wounded in the arms, he could walk. That's so fair enough. You walked. And really, I think it saved more lives than if they'd have ridden on the trucks, because we were all freezing. The shoe packs we had were like a rubber boot that laced up to the middle of your leg, below the knee sort of thing. And you had an inner sole, which was to keep you warm. And you were very warm, but as soon as you started moving, your feet sweated in the socks. And then when you're laying down, whatever, defending a position or and whatever, in the night time, you're laying there all night with the tacks coming on you, your feet freeze. And the inside of your socks, which was moisture, freezes solid. And people had their feet off. There was lots of our chaps had toes off. Americans lost their feet, some lost their legs, their hands, because your hands froze. If you took your glove off and touched a gun, the metal would burn your hand and the skin had come off your hands. The fact of your hand then freezing has put you out of action and you're a casualty. And your hands start to turn black, your feet start to turn black, and you've got frostbite, but you don't realise it because you're inside your shoes. There's a photograph of me upstairs with a group, and it shows us standing there on the 10th of December, when we've reached Coterie before we moved a few more miles to get back down, another 30 miles to get back down to Hamnung. And you look, you can see my feet sticking down in these shoe packs. And I can remember being so cold and frozen at the time. I remember feeling cold. And I also remember one of the sergeants coming up. I was only 18 and still learning. And one of the sergeants coming up and saying, "You all right, Mick?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm okay." And he said, "What's your feet like?" I said, "Oh, all right, I can't feel them. There's me, and I'm okay." And he says, "Right, that means you've got to start kicking some tins." And there was all the discarded rations, tins, which the Chinese had looted and everything, you know, all stuff lying around. And he said, "Right, go kicking these tins until your feet are getting worn." And he was walking along with me, pulling me along. "Come on, kick them, kick them." And I didn't realise that my feet were freezing up and getting frostbite, but he helped to save my feet. And other chaps lost their feet. You know, our own lads lost their feet, half a foot, and so forth. And others, when they're wounded, if they're not been taken care of, in some cases the wound froze and stopped the blood from flowing, if you can understand what I mean. Even if it was a severe wound. But in other cases, the shock of being wounded and then freezing killed them. Like, you know, this is how a lot of other American casualties and so forth were. All this you're learning in a matter of a week. You learn so fast. You grow up. My hair started to go grey from that day, I think. And as you can see, it can be snowy, like, you know. Other things that come to mind, and once again, is the comradeship, and also the funny, not funny now, but what we thought at the time. All along this roadside, going back in daylight, you see the dead Chinese who are putting all these attacks, and some are literally sitting like that with weapons in their hand still, frozen solid, where they've been hit, and they're just gradually dying. Well, they've been hit and died and frozen, like that. And cigarettes stuck in their mouths. A yank could go by and say, "Yeah, I have a cigarette," and this is light. And another yank come walk along and shoots it, you know, thinking that it's an actual chap with a cigarette going to take aim. And so it's just going like that, you know, it's frozen solid. You know, and a cigarette drops out, you know. You saw lots of, it's not atrocities, it's just, once again, I think it's a way of getting something out of your system. You know, you'd seen a dead corpse there, which you don't associate as being a person dead, not being unkind, and is in a position there, and you say, "Oh, have a cigarette," you know. these things just happen, and you see it, like, you know, and they stay in your mind. There's lots of them all imprinted in the snow where the tanks have gone over and things like that. We then got to a place where there was a bridge across a ravine. Now, this was a real problem because there's a sheer drop and the power stations from the reservoir go down hundreds of feet like that, and these big pipes go down, and there's this twisting road through the mountains had been a place where it's just about 20 foot across where the bridge had been built because of the sheer rock there and the sheer drop. And so they built this bridge. It's been there, well, by the North Koreans for years. The Chinese dynamited it and destroyed it, so that there was this gap of about 20 foot. Now, it doesn't seem much, but you couldn't get by. You couldn't climb up the mountains with the vehicles. You couldn't go down. You could climb up and around, but you'd have left all your wounded on the vehicles. So it had to be repaired. And the Americans dropped by air a bridge, and they dropped it right in position, and the American engineers fixed it all up, you know, connected it all together. And that was an actual mission, which whoever organised and did that, every one of them people should have been awarded some form of decoration, because although they may not have fired any bullets, they saved thousands of lives. They did. And it was over a place called the Funchalin or Fuchalin Pass. And if that bridge had not been, or that gap had not been bridged, then I wouldn't be here myself to tell a little bit that I remember of it. And that really of chosen was, from that point on, you felt safe. You relaxed. You still had the odd attacks from Chinese trying to cause a bit of disruption, but they weren't mass attacks. They were where they come up on the hillside, and a few of them have fired down, and they call in a Corsair. As I said, the Corsairs were fantastic. They just come out of nowhere, and so they were our protection on the flanks as we all come down through the safety. I can remember one night, I don't know what date it was, this must have been about 3 or 4 days later, we just carried on walking and walking, and at night time you slept in the cold and defended if they were attacking. We didn't have anything to eat because you couldn't set up any food to do anything. You just found some rations and grabbed them if you saw some packs that had still got some rations in, like, you know. That side of it was a bit chaotic, but our primary task was to get back down with us all safe and bring our wounded and our dead out and equipment, which we did. And the food which you had, which you managed to carry with you or if you found, sort of thing. And I can remember cooking a little tin, and the American ration packs had cookie tins where they'd have some cookies, which are biscuits, and a little flat tin round on that with jam in. And I thought, it's a tin of jam, and I kicked it, and it turned over, and it was empty. And my mate says a few words, like, you know, just that serves you right, like, you know. And the next thing I remember really, that I really enjoyed, was they put us in the dark in these cattle trucks, or coal trucks, you know, like big steel trucks on a railway line. And as we got in, there was these Americans who'd come up from the south to join forces, you know, were coming up to help us, as you might say, and they were very well organised in that they come up to greet us and to save us and to give us support and whatever. And I had this big can shoved in my hand that had been opened. And I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's juice." And it was grapefruit juice. Now, grapefruit is a bit, you know, it went down like the best champagne, like, you know, because the fact that, A, it didn't freeze solid in your hand sort of thing, plus the fact that it was drinkable and you drank it and that. That is another thing. It's very, very small, but I remember that. And that was another point of feeling everything's okay now. I never, ever thought of anything hitting me, because you don't. I don't think anyone does in war, as far as I can think. Everyone thinks the other bloke's going to get it. And I suppose I was much the same. But there's different places and different times when you feel fearful. You're terrified. You know, you are literally, I'll admit it myself, you're terrified, because you know that unknown things are happening, and your mate next to you disappears, and you can't voice the fact that you're terrified, and you don't realise you're terrified because it's all happening. But afterwards, you start to sit and think, like, you know, oh, what's going to happen next, like, you know. And then when it does happen, you forget it and you're doing it, and then afterwards you're terrified. And I say, I was never brave. I can honestly say, I don't think I was brave. I was just doing what I had to do and surviving. And that's the way I must truthfully say, you know. But at the same time, you get these different stages where you feel safer than you did the day before. We then were put on a troop ship called the USS President Jackson. And there was thousands of us on there. You know, this is all Americans, our small unit of Royal Marines, and all these thousands of Americans. You queued up for hours to get to the bathroom. You then threw all your clothes off, because before you went on board, you'd been given a load of new clean clothes to put on. And this massive great bathroom with showers and wash bowls all around was 100 foot by 50 foot sort of thing. And it was knee deep in clothing, which had been discarded, because the Americans had been suffering longer than what we had. You know, when you think of the situation. And so this was, for a lot of them, their first bath in, could have been a month or more, to get to where they can literally have hot water on them and so forth. We used to shave every day at Chosin. Colonel Drysdale insisted. He'd come round, shave. And we were all clean shaven, every one of us. The Americans had thick beards. Every one of the Royal Marines was clean shaven. And this is another thing which the Americans could not understand about us. They said, you guys, you look as though you're on parade. I said, well, no, it's not that. It's the fact that each day you felt fit and clean. And if you're feeling clean, you feel a bit more with it. And you didn't realise this yourself, but it's something that's instilled in you with your training. And Colonel Drysdale, he was a fantastic man. He was a harsh man. He was a kind man. He was a leader. I would have followed him down to hell. I'd have followed him anywhere, even if I knew there wasn't much chance of coming out. Every one of us would, because he was with you all the time as well. And that's what it was like in 4-1 Commando. And so on this ship, everyone was discarding their clothing and getting clean clothing. You queued up to get a meal, you queued up to get back to your bunk space. Now, I had a blue ticket with a bunk number on and a section number. And another chap had a red ticket and another one had a green ticket. And it come over the tannoy, blue tickets to your bunks. And I'd shake the bloke on my number bunk and I'd say, what colour you got? And he's, I've got a red one, guy. And I said, well, I've got a blue one. Out you get, it's my turn to sleep for 8 hours. And then after I've been in it 8 hours, I get a shake. Out I get, and the other. There wasn't any bedding. You just laid on the bunk. It was somewhere to lay to sleep. And you slept in your clothes, but you just laid there. Because there was no room. There was that many people on this ship that you queued up and everything was done like that. The another thing I remember was queuing up in the gangways to get a meal. As soon as you'd had your meal, you started queuing up to get the next meal. Then you started queuing up to go to the bathroom to have a wash, etc. Or you had to force your way through to go to the toilet. And then you queued up to get back towards your bunk, or you queued up to say there's a movie tonight, you know, if you still had enough strength left. And that was it. And another thing I remember was the Americans sitting in these gangways gambling with hundreds of dollars. See, once again, us poor British, you know, sort of, you know, a few little dollars we were earning. But another way of looking back at it, money was nothing. They come out of hell, as you might say, and typical Americans, there was the dice going, you know, and they're all shouting, and piles of dollar bills, and they just scramble it up and put it in their pockets. And every one of them is laughing and so forth. If you could make a film about that sort of thing, to the true side of things, that's the sort of thing you should see, like, you know, and so forth. We got right back down to the south of Japan, and they put us ashore at a place called Maysan, M-A-S-A-N, and it was nothing but a tented camp where you were trying to reorganize yourself, because at the same time, the war was getting worse. Down were coming the North Koreans and the Chinese and pushing all the forces back down to the bottom of Korea. So it wasn't all over. You had to start again to push them back again. And we were down at Maysan to reorganise and regroup and lick our wounds and see what was happening next. Well, we spent Christmas there, Christmas 1950, in Maysan. I can remember a Christmas tree. I'm not being dirty or anything, but there was decorated with toilet rolls, and the Americans always used to be compulsory issued with condoms or whatever. It's part of their way of life, and there was blown up condoms hanging on the Christmas tree as balloons, and bits of tinsel and bits of stuff that you get from ammunition boxes as Christmas. And it was a moving Christmas. We had a church service. and it was time to start thinking of, you know, your mates that have been killed and sort of getting back to being sensible again. You know, you're getting back into the world as you knew it after having experienced something which, don't get me wrong, but I would go through it again, because when you look back, having had some experience like that, you realise the value of just life. Not the fact that you want to be a millionaire, that you want to do this and you want to do that,